Hello and welcome to this podcast from the BBC World Service. Please let us know what you think and tell other people about us on social media. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service, coming to you live from our studios in central London. I'm Julian Marshall. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah on Friday an historic turning point. But a turn in what direction? Towards the victory that Israel seeks in Lebanon by degrading Hezbollah to the point that it no longer poses a threat to northern Israel, meaning that tens of thousands of Israelis can return to their homes? Or will it be a turn towards a deepening conflict that brings in other countries in the region, with Israel finding itself under attack? Hezbollah's key backer, Iran, has called for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council. Speaking to reporters in New York, the Iranian Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said Mr. Nasrallah's killing would not go unpunished.
In our opinion, America is a partner in this crime and cannot separate itself from the reality in any way. And the blood of the martyrs of this incident will certainly not go unanswered. And we will definitely stand by Lebanon.
For the moment, though, Israel seems undeterred. It says it's killed another senior Hezbollah official today and has continued its bombardment of southern Lebanon. My colleague Rebecca Kesby got an update on their military goals from Peter Lerner, spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces.
So we're currently involved in three follow-up operations simultaneously, actually. First of all, of course, in the aftermath of Nasrallah's elimination and his senior advisors, commanders and operators, we are seeking out those that are trying or potentially to become the next leaders. So it's taking out those capabilities. And indeed, we took out yesterday a senior member of the intelligence capabilities of Hezbollah. Obviously, they have not surrendered. And there is, as you rightly pointed out, still extreme threats of more actions. So the second component would be hot interception of those capabilities that are trying to be launched at us from Lebanon by Hezbollah. And the third component, I'll just finish that point, is taking out the strategic assets of cruise missiles, precision guided missiles, rocket launchers, those types of things, so that the operation is ongoing.
So can that be done remotely, or are you looking at a ground assault now?
That's a very good question. The IDF defense chief, speaking to reservists last week, said that we need to be prepared for that. And as a military, hope is not a method. We are indeed preparing our forces, training them. And if the instructions require, then we will push forward. But I think what is most important is that we're able to achieve our goal of restoring and returning 60,000 Israelis that have been living out of home now for a year.
All right, but you know that there is extreme concern in the international sphere as to what happens next. Many are accusing Israel of being reckless by taking this, saying that it escalates the tension in the region further. We've got Iran now pledging revenge. We don't know what form that might take. And not to mention the impact on tens of thousands of civilians in southern Lebanon who have left their homes. We know that at least 800 have been killed over the past week. And when you see the crater, which I believe is about 20 metres deep, left by that explosion that killed Nasrallah on Friday, the impact on the civilians is immense.
Absolutely. The impact on civilians over the last year in this war that began on 7th of October from Gaza, and on the 8th of October when Hezbollah, under Nasrallah's rule, decided to join in, is impacting civilians on both sides of the border. The alternative to not restoring safety and security would be surrender to Hezbollah. And that, from Israel's perspective, obviously is not an option at all.
What about the Americans' plan for a ceasefire and a deal to end the conflict in Gaza? I mean, that's been on the table for months, and the government of Israel has completely ignored the Americans on that issue.
I don't speak for the government as a military spokesperson. I can say from the military perspective, we are creating the opportunities and conditions so that either the government can decide to push forward with a diplomatic solution or create more operations capabilities to seek out and hunt down Yahya Sinwar and to try and create conditions to bring home 101 hostages still being held by Hamas.
That was Peter Lerner, spokesman for the Israel Defense Forces. And as you heard, hundreds of thousands of Lebanese have fled the Israeli bombardment in the south. And Lebanon's acting Prime Minister Najib Mikati said today that figure could increase further, stretching the resources of a country that is in economic meltdown.
The number is very large and may have reached an estimated 1 million people. 1 million Lebanese people who have left from one place to another. It is the largest displacement of people that may have happened in this region or in Lebanon.
And I spoke earlier to Huwaida Turk, governor of the Nabatea region in southern Lebanon.
The Israeli bombardment forced people to flee and made more displaced people leave Nabatea and go to other places, especially from the 23rd of September when this displacement started.
But have there been further Israeli airstrikes in Nabatea today?
There were some Israeli airstrikes in different areas in Nabatea, in Zalta and in the district of Nabatea. So Israeli airstrikes hit many places today. There were 7 people killed from the health sector, people from the ambulance services who were helping people. They were killed today because of the Israeli airstrikes.
What have been the targets of these Israeli airstrikes? What have they been hitting?
I'm not a military expert, but the Israelis targeted civilian buildings. Many people died or were killed because of them, including children. So these were Israeli airstrikes through the last few days.
But Israel says that Hezbollah has been concealing missiles and rockets in residential properties in southern Lebanon.
I don't think so. What we've seen is the destruction of civilian buildings, and many civilians have been killed by Israeli airstrikes. So I don't think the claim of the Israelis that Hezbollah conceal missiles there is true.
What's been the reaction among people in Nabatea to the killing of the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah?
It's painful for the people in the south and in general for the Lebanese people, the killing of Hassan Nasrallah. However, no institutions depend on one person. So someone will succeed him and the institution will carry on as an organization. And everyone wants to have his destiny to be a martyr. He's considered in Lebanon a martyr because he was killed by the Israelis and he defended Lebanese territory against Israel. So he's considered a martyr in some parts of Lebanon.
That was Huwaida Turk, governor of the Nabatea region in southern Lebanon. And let's speak now to the BBC's Lina Sinjab in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. And Lina, the Reuters news agency reporting that Hassan Nasrallah's body has been recovered from the site of an airstrike in Beirut's southern suburbs. Can you confirm that?
Well, that's what also some local media is reporting, and now there are people preparing for the burial. There are still little details about the time or the place of you know, his funeral or his burial. But of course, as we talk, also the airstrikes from the Israelis continue. Just, you know, in the past half an hour, there was another big airstrike also in Dahye, in the Ghbeyli area, which we don't know yet who was the target in this one. So really, I mean, as people are still in the wave of a big shock for them, the loss of a a leader for some, or for others in Lebanon, someone who caused the war in Lebanon. But still, he's a big figure, and he's lost his going to leave Lebanon in really dangerous situation.
Do we have any idea yet of how many civilians were killed in that airstrike on Friday that claimed the lives of Hassan Nasrallah and other members of Hezbollah?
Well, the Ministry of Health, basically, here, when they cite the number of people killed, they don't differentiate between civilians or non-civilians. But on that day, you know, dozens of people were killed in that airstrikes, and more than 70 were injured. We're not sure about the number of civilians because that's not specified by the Ministry of Health. However, since the airstrikes intensified in Lebanon, there are almost 1,000 killed so far today, and there are, among them, many women and children as well.
Hezbollah has just confirmed the death of Ali Karaki, the commander of the group's southern front, in that Friday airstrike. What do we know about him?
Well, he was also part of the leading figures in Hezbollah, and the leading command in Hezbollah. And over the past week, I would say, many commanders were assassinated, totaling almost eliminating the top leadership in Hezbollah. But of course, as this group is structured, or this organization is structured, there is always like a second man or a third man who would come and replace and to fill in the vacuum. However, when we're talking about Nasrallah himself, he was such an important character, almost considered as the pillar of this organization. So whoever comes to replace him, many would argue that will not fill that gap.
I know that in the immediate aftermath of Hassan Nasrallah's killing, there were concerns that it could inflame sectarian tensions in Lebanon. Have those fears now dissipated?
Well, today is a quiet day, and even the streets in Beirut have come back to a little bit of a movement, but not a normal movement. Like yesterday, all of the streets of Beirut had families stretched all over, sleeping on the floor. Now most of them, those were taken to shelters. You still find scattered number of families on the streets. Yesterday, there was some tension in some areas, but I think everyone is really looking at the situation in very much caution, so that to avoid this country slipping into internal, conflict. Some of the leaders of the parties here mourned the death of Nasrallah, even among the Christians or the Druze leader. So I think everyone is waiting in anticipation what the Hezb will do, when the Hezb will, when Hezbollah will going to regain force, and what Iran is going to respond. That's going to, depict the coming days and weeks and probably months to come.
Look, Lina, many thanks for that. That was the BBC's Lina Sinjab speaking from the Lebanese capital, Beirut. You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Julian Marshall, and this is NewsHour. Coming up ahead of tonight's U.S. vice presidential debate between J.D. Vance and Tim Walz, we hear from voters in a key swing district in Nebraska.
What I hear when they talk about Walz is he's very relatable. He's, one of us. They just trust him. I think a lot of people are very tired of the divisiveness and the bitterness, and so he's anything but that.
And the latest headlines from the BBC News from the Prime Minister of Lebanon says up to 1 million people may have been forced from their homes because of continuing Israeli attacks. And more than 120 people have died in flooding and landslides in Nepal. Many are still missing. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour live from the BBC in London. This is the time of the year when South Asia experiences often fatal rain-related flooding and landslides, and much of Nepal is currently inundated after heavy monsoon rains, the heaviest in over half a century, and more than 126 people are known to have died. The BBC's Sanjay Dakal is in the capital, Kathmandu.
There was an incessant rainfall since Friday, and today, on Sunday, from morning, there's no rainfall. So rainfall has subsided, at least in Kathmandu. And water levels in most of the rivers in Kathmandu and also outside the city, they are receding. So the weather-wise, also it is improving. So after we are all counting the flood aftermath now.
And what were the water levels at the peak of this flooding?
During the peak of the flooding, one of the major rivers in Kathmandu city, Bagmati, it had almost come to the level of the bridge. So it was really bad situation all around Kathmandu and also outside the valley. And most rivers, they had a very high current and the water level had reached two dangerous levels.
And which part of the country was worst affected?
The flooding happened mostly in east and central Nepal, Kathmandu Valley being one of them. In Kathmandu Valley alone, there were 2,000 houses inundated. 34 people lost their lives. In a highway near Kathmandu, some vehicles were found buried under landslide, and police are just recovering dead bodies from them. They have already recovered at least 27 dead bodies. These people were headed to Kathmandu when they were caught in a landslide, apparently. And also another neighboring district of Kabre is also quite badly affected. So it was mostly concentrated in central and eastern Nepal.
Do you think it's likely as the recovery operation proceeds that the number of dead will increase?
And that looks likely, yes. For the time being, the authorities are saying that the death toll has reached almost 130, but there are still 63 people missing. So yes, the death toll can be expected to rise.
And how has the government responded?
Well, if you look at the social media, the government is being criticized for delayed response and slow response. They have announced free treatment and relief, and also mobilized army, police and armed police force across the country. But the pace of their rescue operations and their response has been criticized heavily in social media.
Nepal gets this kind of rainfall every year at this time of the year, but it does appear that this rainfall has been a lot heavier.
Yes, it is a monsoon, so it is normal to have a rainfall in this part of the year. So, scientists have been saying that rainfall events are becoming more intense due to climate change. They are saying warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture, leading to more rainfall. That is one concern here, that climate change may also be playing its part to deteriorate the situation. But this season is a monsoon season, so all of South Asia, it is a rainy season as well.
And is the government taking any steps at all to adapt to what are likely to be heavier rains in the future?
They have been making statements that they are taking steps for adapting to new normal, as they say, for extremely heavy rainfall concentrated in a short period of time. But there's only so much that they can do. There's no concerted effort from authorities or other experts for this to address this kind of situation. But going forward, this is going to be one of the most biggest challenge for countries like Nepal.
That was the BBC's Sanjay Dakal in the Nepali capital, Kathmandu. And since we spoke to him, the Nepali police have given an update on the number of dead from those floods and landslides. It now stands at 148, with over 50 still missing. One of Georgia's most important cultural exports is its tradition of rich polyphonic music sung by multiple voices. This week, choirs from around the world gathered at polyphonic music's cultural heartland in the Caucasus, Tbilisi, Georgia. The BBC's Rehan Dimitri went there to find out what makes Georgian songs so spellbinding.
This is a German choir singing a Georgian classic, Alelo. The choir formed over Zoom during the pandemic, and they specialize in singing Georgian polyphonic music. Maren and Sabine are thrilled that their choir is performing in Georgia itself for the first time.
We are all practicing in small ensembles all over Germany and also Austria. It's hard to imagine that we are in Georgia because we get a deeper connection to how the music feels in this country. And
okay, but we love the music so much, and to hear the music, it makes really
goosebumps. So,
yes, and
but what is this like? Can you explain for those who don't know, those who never practice singing? What is it about specifically this music that makes you feel this way?
It touched me, and one song, a Georgian song, could be heard so different. Not like one song always the same, always another feeling, but always deep.
Georgian polyphony is a type of music featuring multiple vocal parts, typically three distinct groups of voices involving harmonies, sung without instrumental accompaniment. International choirs from Europe, US and Canada have gathered in Tbilisi for the country's annual folk festival to perform alongside Georgian ensembles, sharing their passion for this enchanting music and showcasing their own traditional music. A Welsh lullaby by Trio Samaya. They are part of a bigger community choir known as Kakali, which means walnut in Georgian.
Walnut. Yeah, now they're in season, the green ones.
Yeah, we're just nuts.
Liz Womsey from the Trio Samaya describes the effect Georgian polyphonic singing has on her.
I was a music teacher a long time ago. That was my training initially. But it was the Georgian songs that just opened my heart to singing in my lower register voice, and it changed my life, actually. And it is a heartfelt experience of open-heartedness. I don't know what it is. I don't think there's a word for it, but it met my soul.
That's a report by the BBC's Rehan Dimitri in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is NewsHour. Do stay with us. There's a lot more to come in the next 30 minutes.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems, and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. A coalition of environmental NGOs are calling on the UK government to take action on climate change and ratify the United Nations High Seas Treaty. The groundbreaking agreement would allow the creation of protected ocean areas to combat the loss of biodiversity and the impact of global warming. Sarah Minetta has more.
A couple of birds swoop on the still waters of a pond as storm clouds gather above the mountains in Svalbard.
In past years, all of these flats and this water would be covered with birds. They would be here in massive quantities, and now there's just nothing.
Elizabeth Bourne is a photographer who moved here in 2018. She's been documenting the changes happening in this remote archipelago in the Arctic.
It's sometimes hard for people to believe the rate of change that is happening there. I saw glaciers that had been touching the sea when I first moved there, and they're now on land.
Elizabeth sent me a video of a stream of muddy water flowing down from a dying glacier. A stark reminder, the Arctic is warming at a rate of 3 times faster than the rest of the world. The changes in the environment and the impact of increased human activity are putting the whole ecosystem under severe strain.
The ship has reached the shore.
In a landmark moment, last year the United Nations approved a treaty to safeguard the high seas, the vast portion of oceans that don't belong to any one country. But the treaty hasn't come into effect yet.
It is a shorter distance from Outstack to the Arctic Circle than it is from London to Edinburgh. So there's this constant flux of wildlife moving between the Arctic Ocean and the Northern Isles of the United Kingdom.
Standing on the pebble shore in Unst in the Shetland Islands, British polar explorer Pen Haddo points at Outstack, the northernmost part of Scotland. The wildlife population here has also been steadily declining, and Penn's NGO, the 90 North Foundation, are calling on the UK government to take action.
If the UK government can encourage and exhort and support a number of other countries, that's an X number more ticks, if you like, ratifications, getting us up to that number 60, then we can start protecting the high seas around the world.
In response to a BBC request, the UK government said they are determined to take the lead internationally on climate. But Penn fears countries are acting too slowly.
The only thing that keeps us going is biodiversity. That's what keeps us alive. Nothing else. And we're just chewing into it as if it's like an endless resource and nothing really changes.
That report by Sarah Minetta. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. I'm Julian Marshall. And expanding on our top story, that estimate from Lebanon's acting prime minister that the continuing bombardment by Israel of the south of the country could displace as many as 1 million people. Nasser Yassin is Lebanon's minister of environment and has been given responsibility for providing for all those internally displaced people. I spoke to him just before we came on air and asked him where those fleeing the south were now.
We've been registering displaced Lebanese, particularly in the last few days. But for the past 20 hours, we've seen an exponential increase after the bombardment of the southern suburbs of Beirut. This is a crowded part of metropolitan Beirut, and almost everybody left their buildings and they went to the city of Beirut, to the main capital, but also to the neighboring towns, villages, reaching up to the borders with Syria in the north. So our record now looks like we have almost 250,000 people in collective shelter, formally registered or being registered at the moment. And we estimate that the majority are in houses with other families, in makeshift buildings, many families coming together in one apartment. This is the percentage of people who live in collective shelter is usually between 20 to 30%. So this is the number of the 1 million of people being directly affected or being displaced by the latest aggression on the different parts of Lebanon.
I know at one point you were using schools to house internally displaced people. Is that still the case?
Definitely. The 250,000 in collective shelter are mostly in public schools, but also private schools, youth clubs, colleges, and other public buildings that were made available. At the moment, those who are registered are in around 778 public schools are being used now as collective shelter.
Who's feeding these people? Who's providing them with water, drinkable water?
We've activated a response plan with the UN agencies. This we started early on when we realized that things are moving and going into in this down spiral with intensified attacks on Lebanon. So we activated the collaboration with the United Nations agencies, particularly OCHA, but also WFP, UNICEF, and others. We're still under a lot of pressure to serve people. The needs are immense. With 1 million Lebanese, that's around 20 to 25% of the Lebanese population being displaced or being directly affected. We have short of funds, whether at the government level or with the UN agencies. A lot of the Lebanese communities have pitched in, they jumped in to help their fellow Lebanese. But, you know, this can happen for the first few days. So we're very concerned if this humanitarian situation becomes protracted and stays for the weeks to come.
I know Lebanon was already a refuge for tens of thousands of Syrian refugees.
Millions
of
Lebanon has been hosting around 2 million refugees.
Okay.
1.5 million officially recognized Syrian refugees.
Okay.
And around almost half a million Palestinian refugees.
And those Syrians, have they been heading home?
Very modest numbers have been heading home. All of them are actually looking for refuge. Many of them are on the streets. UNHCR is struggling to cope with their needs. The Lebanese state doesn't want to discriminate, but as you may understand, we're giving priority now for the Lebanese population in collective shelter, and we're trying to find a solution with UNHCR to put the Syrian refugees being displaced another time, unfortunately, in some of the informal tented settlements or some of the collective shelter that's being run by the UNHCR or by other UN agencies.
How do you see all this being resolved, Minister? How do you see this conflict in the south coming to an end?
We need to stop this war. We need to go back to respecting UN resolution, chief among them 1701, which hasn't been in practice, violated by the Israeli army, being violated time and again in the past few months by violating the sovereignty of Lebanon, the airspace, and even now there are some signs of preparation for a ground invasion. We need to go back to the international community, the UN resolution, international laws to be applied today as soon as possible. This can slide or could slide to a major humanitarian catastrophic situation in the world, not only for the Lebanese, but also for the hundreds of thousands of Syrians and Palestinians who live in Lebanon.
That was Lebanon's Minister of the Environment, Nasser Yassin. Well, there's undoubtedly been shock in Lebanon at the death of the leader of a group which has dominated the country's political and military landscape for more than 30 years. Shock, but also ambivalence, both in Lebanon and indeed the rest of the region. Hassan Nasrallah was the leader of a Shia Islamist militant group in a country with multiple religious affiliations. He was also backed by an external power, Iran. And Hezbollah fighters have been involved in conflicts in Syria and Iraq, even though their ostensible enemy was Israel. On September the 19th, in what turned out to be one of his last video addresses, Mr. Nasrallah warned Israel of serious consequences after dozens of people were killed and 3,000 injured when Hezbollah-owned pagers and walkie-talkies exploded.
There is no doubt that the aggression that took place is a major one. And as I said in my speech, it is unprecedented and will be met with tough retribution and just retribution and just punishment, where they expect it and where they do not.
Well, I'm joined now by Azadeh Mouaveni, Professor of Journalism at New York University. And I understand you spent a bit of time with Nasrallah some time ago. I mean, can you give me some idea of how you found him?
Of course, yes, I did. I interviewed him in 2000, the year that Hezbollah liberated southern Lebanon from Israeli occupation, back in the times when he was still meeting with journalists. I found him striking. He was very worldly. He was very well-mannered. He was funny. He was really a very gifted politician. He spoke Persian fluently as well as Arabic. He was really a man apart from the other types of leaders one would encounter in the Middle East. He wasn't dogmatic or austere like other Islamist militants. He wasn't corrupt. He didn't have children who lived in Marbella and London. You know, he lost a son in fighting against Israel. So he was really quite distinct in the region. And I think that was really part of his appeal across both the Arab world, the wider region. He was a military leader. He was a religious leader. He was a leader of a state within a state. And he just had a big commanding personality. And he could play all of these roles at once and appeal across all these different constituencies.
Do you think that maybe since 2000, perceptions of Mr. Nasrallah have changed? I mean, to what extent has he been pursuing Hezbollah's agenda in the region or Iran's?
It's a good question. And I think given just the nature of Hezbollah, its very origins set up, partly with Iranian backing to oppose Israel in Lebanon. It swung back and forth. In 2000, they were national heroes, the only Arab force to ever defeat Israel anywhere. In 2005, when Hezbollah was believed to be implicated in the killing of the Lebanese leader Rafiq Hariri, he was seen as furthering a Syrian agenda. In the Syrian civil war, I think it became very mixed because he was seen by many as fighting on the side of Bashar Assad to prop up his own regime. But also, it was Hezbollah that defended Christian villages on the border against Syria against ISIS. That was a genocidal force targeting not only Shia, but Christian Arabs. So there have been moments after moments where he has been seen as advancing a foreign agenda, but then the tumult of the region and the instability following the Arab Spring did also bring these moments when it was seen that it was between Hezbollah and ISIS, that this was the only force, you know, protecting Lebanon. So it's mixed, you know, it's sort of the tapestry of his legacy is that he defended Lebanon. He defended multiple sects of Lebanon at crucial moments. And at many moments, he defended the interests of his patrons that were foreign to Lebanon.
I mean, Hezbollah is very keen on saying, you know, that those who have been assassinated will be replaced by others. But it's difficult, is it not, to envisage a leader quite like Hassan Nasrallah emerging from Hezbollah's ranks, particularly somebody with whom Iran can do business?
Indeed. There are other senior Hezbollah figures who have deep links with Iran's Revolutionary Guard. The man who's mentioned as part of the succession possibilities for him is said to have a son married to a prominent, you know, child of an Iranian general. So there are these longstanding ties, but it is indeed difficult to see someone emerging who has the sort of charisma, the seasoned sort of military experience, the diplomatic skill, in a way that I think we have to acknowledge that he had to sort of take that place. So I think it is a question, you know, will Hezbollah exist in the same way after this week?
I mean, more generally, do you feel that his death might undermine Hezbollah's standing and indeed influence in Lebanon itself?
I think that's the question of the hour. We just simply don't know if the Hezbollah that
that Iran and Hezbollah itself had presented to the region as this mighty paramilitary force with this deep arsenal of missile and rockets, does this still exist? Is the remaining Hezbollah leadership or Iran deciding not to use it? Are they standing down, or has it been dismantled and destroyed by a ferocity of Israeli attack that I don't think anyone, imagined would ever sort of emerge in this way? So I think the nature of Hezbollah, what we thought it to be and what it can be, will really only, emerge in the next weeks and months.
And very, very briefly, will Iran feel obliged to react to his death? Very, very briefly.
Iran has no good options. If it doesn't respond, it looks to have sort of propped up a deterrent strategy that's empty. If it does respond, it risks internal destabilization. And that's something that ultimately the Iranian regime sees as its priority, is propping up its hold domestically. So there are no good options for Iran.
Azadeh Moaveni, Professor of Journalism at New York University, many thanks. This is Julian Marshall with NewsHour from the BBC World Service. Next week, for the first time, the two men vying to be America's next vice president for the Blue Democratic side, Tim Walz, and for the Red side, Republican J.D. Vance, will take to a debate stage in New York just 5 weeks ahead of an election that remains too close to call. For both Kamala Harris and Donald Trump, their running mates have been picked, in part, for their white Midwestern roots, a demographic seen as key to taking the White House. Our reporter John Sudworth has been to the great Midwestern state of Nebraska to find out how their distinct visions for the revival of small-town rural America are being received.
At a cattle auction in central Nebraska, the animals are brought in batches. The bidding is fast and furious, and the prices are high.
This is a great car.
Oh, thanks.
What is it, like an old Ford?
1977 Ford Mustang.
Yes, stunning.
I meet two ranchers, Colby and Sterling. While the industry might be doing okay at the moment, there's still a palpable political gloom in the air.
Prices of groceries and rent and everything just going up here in the last 4 years has been ridiculous.
Cost of living so high, and yeah, prices are up on cattle, but our profit margin is actually way lower than it has been in the last 5-10 years. It's getting harder every day.
Colby tells me he knows how he's voting come November, and he doesn't care about Trump's criminal record or the violence on January the 6th as he tried to hold on to power.
I'm definitely going to go towards Trump because I honestly feel like we need a businessman. And I know I do not trust Harris with, I guess, my money. But Trump, he's business. And who cares about the record? I have a lot of buddies that has mishap. I never look at them different.
Who hasn't stormed the Capitol?
Oh.
I grew up in Butte, Nebraska.
The fight for America's rural vote is highlighted by the choice of the two vice presidential running mates.
Growing up in a small town like that, you learn how to take care of each other.
Kamala Harris's VP pick is Tim Walz, a man born in small town Nebraska before moving to Minnesota to become a teacher, football coach, and then governor, championing things like tax credits to families and free school meals.
I grew up in Middletown, Ohio.
Donald Trump's choice, on the other hand, is a man with a far less optimistic framing of his Midwestern roots.
But it was also a place that had been cast aside and forgotten by America's ruling class in Washington.
J.D. Vance rose to prominence with his best-selling book, Hillbilly Elegy, the story of growing up in poverty in Ohio and his mother's fight with addiction. Now a U.S. senator, he champions individualism over welfare.
So what I'm doing is our original technique, creating blue dot signs.
There is one scenario in which the future of America could be decided in the great rural state of Nebraska.
Swirl, swirl, and voila, take off the stencil, there's a blue dot sign.
In their backyard, in the center of the city of Omaha, Jason Brown and Ruth Hubner Brown are spraying giant blue dots on plain white lawn signs.
We live in a red state, but this area of the state sometimes goes red and sometimes goes blue.
Unlike most of the rest of America, where all the Electoral College votes go to the winner of the popular vote in each state, three of Nebraska's Electoral College votes are decided by the popular vote in each of three smaller districts.
It could absolutely, I guess you would say, be a history-changing moment. This could really be the ultimate one vote matters.
Here in the second district, that one electoral vote went to Joe Biden in 2020, a small blue dot in a sea of red. And this time round, it's possible, if the votes elsewhere land a certain way, that it might just prove the tiebreaker that decides the 2024 election. And there's hope among Democrats that the choice of Tim Walz will convince voters to keep Nebraska's blue dot blue.
What I hear when they talk about Walz is he's very relatable. He's, you know, one of us. They just trust him. I think a lot of people are very tired of the divisiveness and the bitterness. And so he's anything but that.
I caught a catfish yesterday, but we'll see.
Shauna Callahan is casting for catfish under a setting sun in the Two Rivers Recreation Area just outside Omaha, and with those economic woes never far from the surface.
Everything costs more. I drive a F-150. When Trump was in office, I was paying about $55 for a tank of gas. Right now, it's anywhere between $100 or $85.
It was COVID that helped depress oil prices during Trump's presidential term. But economics is a feeling in U.S. elections, not a graph. And for Shauna, the hard lessons of J.D. Vance's story and his mother's struggle with drugs, which she knows from the film version of his book, resonate deeply.
The beginning of the movie is like, you know, family is always going to back you up. I mean, that's kind of the way it is out here. I'm only 42, and I've had like three friends die of fentanyl.
This is a soybean, is it?
Yes, it is.
Can they be eaten straight off the thing like that?
Yeah, you can.
Dennis Fuyan is a soybean farmer. He's running for local office while also fighting to turn Nebraska's blue dot back to red. And even here, in the heart of the American countryside, he believes voters are being won over by Donald Trump's messaging on illegal migration.
They should not be here, and then they're siphoning Social Security benefits.
They just stopped there. I'm not sure that undocumented migrants are able to claim Social Security.
Well, you may be right, but they're still not citizens. And so if you're not a citizen, you shouldn't be voting, and I don't know if they are, but I hear they are.
Sorry, Dennis, to keep interrupting, but very little evidence that they are. In fact, no evidence.
Okay. But there's plenty of word that they are. You know, and I'm not trying to say that what I'm telling you is factual. What I'm telling you is what I hear.
There are resonances of J.D. Vance's approach here. His recent claim that migrants are eating pets in his home state was based not on fact, he said, but on what he was hearing. Dennis tells me something else interesting. Trump's tariffs hurt soybean farmers like him when China retaliated and closed its markets.
China was getting like two-thirds of the soybeans grown in the United States were going to China. And those tariffs just shut everything off quite a bit. So we have had to actually work harder to develop other markets.
Here is a presidential candidate who last time round hit your industry, your business, with a trade war that lost one of your biggest markets. What do you see in it?
What we've gotten from the Trump administration is a government that has gotten more out of the way of our operation.
Donald Trump knows that places like these were key to his 2016 victory. And in a race that'll be decided on small swings, both parties are fighting in the U.S. countryside for every vote.
John Sudworth reporting from the U.S. state of Nebraska and bringing to an end this edition of NewsHour. From me, Julian Marshall, and the rest of the team in London, goodbye.
I'm Gabriel Gatehouse, and from BBC Radio 4, this is Series 2 of The Coming Storm. There's a divide in American politics between those who think democracy is in peril and those who think it's already been subverted, hollowed out from the inside. As America prepares to elect its next president, we go through the looking glass into a world where nothing is as it seems and the institutions of the state are a facade. Listen wherever you get your BBC podcasts.